And welcome everyone to another Smart Money Circle show. I'm Adam Sarhan. With me today is Ted Karkus, who's the CEO and chairman of the board at ProPhase Labs, ticker symbol PRPH. Ted, thank you so much for taking the time and welcome to the Smart Money Circle.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for having me on your show. Let's kick it off. Go for it.
So Ted, I always like to begin. Can you please tell us about your journey and how you got to where you are today, please?
Sure. So I'm going to give you the short version. The short version is my parents got divorced when I was about 13 years old. I checked out on life, but my mother was a learning specialist. And so I always made sure to get good grades in school, even though I didn't like to try very hard. And then she was eccentric, that's putting it mildly. She went into psychoanalysis,
wow,
which is a intense form of psychotherapy, of therapy. And I saw the changes it made in her. And in my late 20s, she said, Ted, if you want to get your act together, do the same thing. I went into psychoanalysis. I was lying on a couch 4 days a week. And I didn't know I was going to get into this in this interview, but you know, this is the way it happened. And I learned to have confidence in myself. I learned that it's okay, whatever thoughts I have, who I am as a human being, who I am as a person. I learned to start talking straight with people. And I learned to start taking my life seriously. Everything changed. Wow. I went from never having long-term relationships to meeting my wife and getting married. We've been married 29 years. Yeah. I don't believe any of that would have happened had I not gone into psychoanalysis. Funny thing is, my father was a psychiatrist.
Wow.
I learned more from my mother and then the other part of this, both of my parents had their own businesses and they were entrepreneurs. And so they didn't teach me to be an entrepreneur, but I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. And so I didn't love, I used to work on Wall Street. I worked for investment banks, wasn't happy. In my mid to late 30s, I started getting involved in investing in various companies. And that's when my career and my life really took off.
I love that. So what brought you to ProPhase Labs?
Wow. Okay. So I was involved with a company up in Canada called ID Biomedical. A friend of mine told me. So what happened is when I was younger, I used to love investing in companies. Rather than doing schoolwork, I went to Columbia University, graduated at the top of my class with an MBA. Honestly, didn't really go to class a lot, though. I was more into investing. So I'd invest in these small cap companies. It sounds hokey. I like helping people. I like helping people make money. It's what since I was a little boy, I've just always liked helping people. So here I am, I'm investing in these various companies. It didn't cost me anything to tell my friends what I was investing in, so they invested too. Never asked them for a penny. I just like doing this. No ulterior motives, no big game plan. As we got older and became more successful, our investments became larger. So there's this one company, ID Biomedical, a little $2-3 stock. A friend of mine, you know, thought I'd buy 10,000 shares of it. Before I was done, my friends and I bought 5 million shares out of 13 million shares outstanding.
Wow.
Then I see that the management of the company is burning through all the cash, look like they're going out of business, they're gonna go bankrupt. I flew up to Canada. I ended up forcing the CEO out of the company, promoted the two guys underneath, did two financings for them, set them in a new direction, forced them to fire half their workforce. And instead of going bankrupt, 7 years later, they were sold for $1.4 billion. Now, I don't take credit for the sale, but I do take credit for turning around the company. If I hadn't gotten involved, the company would have gone bankrupt. So now, the reason I tell you that background is around that time, I got involved in the company that I'm now the CEO. So back in 1996, I was the original investor when the company introduced a product called Cold Ease Cold Remedy. It's a zinc lozenge for the common cold. Cleveland Clinic did a study. It said that the product worked great, got an enormous amount of free press. The demand for the product went through the roof. All the consumers were looking for it. The company didn't have the money to manufacture it. I provided working capital to the company. But as with many managements, most managements of development stage companies, they can tell you a great story. In this case, the Cleveland Clinic was the one telling the great story. They fell into success, but then they went from being a hugely profitable company, making a lot of money, to within 2 years, they were actually losing money. The stock went from one to 22 and a half in 1997, went all the way back to a dollar.
Oh, wow.
Then the company diversified. My friends and I reinvested. At this point, I'm now more successful than my friends are. Our investments were larger and larger. So now we're talking about millions, if not tens of millions of dollars we're investing. And then management did some things that, let's just call it highly questionable. So with my experience with ID Biomedical, with forcing out the CEO, I was like, I can do this again. And so, but instead of doing it as an outside advisor or, you know, sort of activist investor, I launched what's called a proxy contest.
Yeah.
And in a proxy contest, you nominate a board of directors. I'd never done this. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I nominated a board of directors, ended up in two federal lawsuits trying to block me from the proxy. It was $2 million of legal fees in like a very short period of time. Fortunately, I won. So because I won, the company paid my legal fees. Otherwise, it literally could have bankrupted me because most of my net worth at the time was invested in the company that I'm now fighting with. I win control. After I win control, I find out that the assets that I was most excited about were worthless and I had to write them all off. The only thing left in the company was potentially a bankrupt company. This is going back a dozen years. The stock's 65 cents. Stock's now up 10 times since then. And I paid out $2.40 in special dividends. So over the last 10, 11 years, my investors that have been with me, I'm the largest shareholder in the company. My friends are the other largest shareholders. Most of them have been with me 10, 15 years, 20, even 20 years, even back to when I went to Columbia Business School 30 years ago, or even longer. And the bottom line is their returns are somewhere around 12, 13, 14 times their investment since the stock bottomed at 65 cents in 2012. So I turned around the company, wrote off most of the assets, looked like the company was going bankrupt, similar to ID Biomedical. They had one asset, Cold-EEZE, but the Cold-EEZE sales had been declining for 4 or 5 years. Looked like the brand was going out of business. So I had to roll up my sleeves, learn how to be a CEO, learn the consumer products industry, fired 22 out of 26 people in the headquarters in the first 6 months, fired every vendor, every consultant. I had to learn marketing and then built a marketing plan from scratch, turned around the Cold-EEZE brand, and ultimately sold her for $50 million.
Wow.
That's the background of the company.
I love that. I love that. Great story. Right?
So I did right by the shareholders. I did right by myself. And that pretty much got me up to saying, okay, what do I do with the company now? So we now had the $50 million, had to pay taxes. The stock was undervalued. So I did stock buybacks. I paid special dividends. I didn't squander a single penny of the money. And I waited for the right opportunities. And that's what led me to what we've been doing for the last several years. But it all started with me taking over control with a proxy contest, turning around the company. I've never squandered a penny ever. And the one thing I learned back when I used to work, I started my career working on Wall Street. I was never happy there. I didn't like wearing a suit and tie. I don't like the political ladder. I don't like the corporate politics. But what I learned back then, back when I was an institutional salesman and working with institutional investors, the most important thing to think about is when managing a company, or investing in a company, terminal value on a per share basis.
Love it.
What's the company worth today divided by the number of shares outstanding? What's the company going to be worth in 2, 3, 5, 10 years divided by the shares outstanding then? So the way I operate our company is anytime I'm going to raise money or issue shares versus debt or however, the first thing I think about is, are we building the underlying value on a per share basis longer term? So that's how I operate the company. And that's why when we sold the Cold-EEZE brand for $50 million, I didn't squander a single penny of the money. I did all the right things to get us to the point where as new opportunities presented themselves, I could jump on them.
I love that. Okay, well, that's a perfect segue. Can you please tell us about the current business, ProPhase Labs, what you do and some of your competitive advantages?
Sure, okay. So we sold the Cold-EEZE brand, but we kept the manufacturing facility. Now, interestingly, when we sold the Cold-EEZE brand, we sold it for so much money, the buyer, if they said, we'll only buy the Cold-EEZE brand if you throw in the manufacturing facility, I might have thrown it in at the time. And I'm going to get to this in a minute. Our manufacturing facility is now exploding in value. I'll get into that in a moment. But just to go back one step, when we sold the Cold-EEZE brand, I was like, okay, what do we do now? At some point along came COVID. I'd never been in the COVID testing business before. It didn't exist before, but I had never been in the laboratory business before. But I saw an opportunity. I saw the opportunity because another company that I was invested in already was fully set up to be, they were in the lab business for 10 years. They were validated for COVID testing, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into the details, but originally with some of the money of the proceeds from the Cold-EEZE sale, we were investing in this other company.
Got it.
But so to put this in perspective though, we started lending them money. I just wanted a return on the investment. They weren't executing with the money that we were lending them. So I said, forget it, we'll do it ourselves. What's interesting is that company is now bankrupt. Our company went down to do $200 million of revenues in 2 years. Well, we had never been in the business.
Love it.
And I don't even care about the applause. We had never been in the business, yet a company that had been in the business for 10 years, one of the first validated for saliva testing for COVID, they went bankrupt and we generated $200 million in revenues. And so at the end of the day, the most important thing, sometimes people will tell you this, investors will tell you, the most important thing is management, management, and management. But it's very difficult to assess management, particularly of microcap companies, because it's typically startups with relatively new managements don't have a track record. Right. There's no way to assess them, right? So I have a track record. And that's why I have shareholders that have been with me for 10, 15, 20 years. And so now that's a sort of a long-winded way of saying we got into COVID testing. We did $200 million of revenues approximately over 2 years from never being in the business. Our stock went from whatever, went from, you know, $3 to $16, whatever, raised a block of money that I used to really build out the business. We built a world-class COVID testing laboratory in Garden City, New York. But the investors knew at some point COVID would end. And so sure enough, as our revenues ended, our stock pulled all the way back down. We went from making money to losing money. Now, when I took over and I was turning around the Cold-EEZE brand, we were losing money for a few years back then, but we were losing it by investing in the brand to turn it around and build up the value. So we lost a few million dollars, but then I sold a brand that was essentially worthless. I sold it for $50 million. Right. So now we're back the same thing. After doing the COVID testing for a couple of years, I didn't sit on my hands for those couple of years. We acquired, there was a three-year bear market in microcap stocks.
Yeah.
During that bear market, some of the technologies, biotechnology assets and other assets, tremendous potential, they couldn't raise money. All these companies that were losing money could not raise money, and a lot of them squandered the money that they had. They were in awful positions. We were in a position sitting on cash, especially with the COVID testing, and so we used that cash. I probably reviewed 200 or 300 different acquisitions, cherry-picked the two or three best that had the best upside potential. That's what we've been developing for the last 3 years. So now we've fully transitioned the company from a COVID testing company to developing these other assets. Yeah, these other assets are now about to bear significant fruit in the next 6 months to 2 years. And I believe the value is going to explode in those assets, dwarfing what we did in COVID testing. So if you think about it in terms of our stock price went up on the COVID testing, everyone got scared. We started losing money, the stock comes all the way down. Now we just reported our worst earnings quarter. Stock actually went up because everybody knows that we've now transitioned. We're no longer a COVID testing company that's dying. We now have these really exciting assets that are growing in value. So our stock, I believe, is bottoming. I don't know if as a CEO, I'm supposed to talk about stock price, but our stock's bottoming. And now the value of our underlying assets is growing. And so they're really exciting things that I'm working on going forward.
Let's talk about those assets. We have, sure. I know, yeah, by all means, go for it.
Okay, good. So basically three assets I'm going to talk about. So the first one, I find this one really interesting. It's our Pharmaloz manufacturing facility that manufactures lozenges. I always thought of this as a boring business. We've owned it for 25, 30 years. And as I said, I might've given it away when the company bought our Cold-EEZE line. What's interesting is in the last couple of years, the demand for lozenges has continued to grow. There are lots of brands out there that are liquids and other forms that want to offer a lozenge. At the same time, the demand for lozenges for the current lozenge brands has grown. All of these lozenge brands have tremendous demand and the capacity for manufacturing has shrunk. So this has been going on for a couple of years now. So we now have transitioned our manufacturing facility to be in growth mode. So to put it in perspective, we generated about $9.5 million last year, $9.7 million, lost a little bit of money. We then increased prices on everybody. Everybody accepted our price increase. Those have kicked in now. So just on the price increase alone, that took our business from a little over 9 million to now 11 million, a profitable business. Then 2 months ago, we signed on two new customers, adding another 5 million of revenues. Now we just signed in another one. So while that's all going on, it's just really a matter of how quickly we can build our capacity. Mm-hmm. So in this business, what's interesting, there isn't a lozenge manufacturing line lying around to be bought. It's made to order. So when you want to order a new manufacturing line, it takes a year to build, 2 months to ship, 2 months to install. It's a year and a half process. So what we're building right now and have been working on for the last year and a half, 2 years, if somebody knew, if a major brand wanted to build this capacity themselves, it would take them 5 or 6 years and cost over $100 million.
Wow.
So they're all desperate. They see what we have. We own on 12 acres, a 60,000 square foot facility. There's one manufacturing line in there. We have a second line that we ordered a year and a half ago. It's about to be installed in the next couple of months. It's going to take our capacity up to like $45, $50 million. That includes all the automation equipment that we've been installing. So our capacity is going from $10 million to $50 million. Our demand is going through the roof. And then we have two more lines coming at year end that's going to take us to close to $100 million of capacity. What's interesting is the net profit margins are like 25%.
Oh, wow.
Net, that's net. That's not gross margins, that's net. That's our pre-tax, that's our actual profit. So right. If we're doing $50 million in revenues, our profit on that will probably be between $12 and $15 million. $100 million, you can double that. So you can see how as we build the capacity and as we bring in more brands, the sky is the limit. But so what's interesting about it, just with what the value of our manufacturing facility is likely to be later this year, it could be more than the entire market cap of our company. The whole market cap of our company right now is $100 million approximately. I think the manufacturing facility alone within a year could be worth $150 million. If I keep it for two and a half years, it could be worth $250 million. Crazy numbers, but the demand is coming in. We've now, for the last year and a half, been working with two of the largest lozenge brands in the world. Key executives are flying in from around the world just to meet me in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, in the middle of Amish country to check out our facility. It's an incredible facility. They're all impressed. So that business is exploding before our eyes. Then we have these two other businesses. One is Nebula Genomics. We do something called whole genome sequencing, founded by George Church of Harvard University, world renowned in the field of genomics over the last 15, 20 years. And he founded this company with two PhD students. We acquired it. His name, George Church, as I said, George had a choice of cashing out or taking stock in our company. He's such a big believer in what we're doing. He took stock in our company and agreed. He never does this, agreed to be on our advisory board. He's introduced us to all the world leaders in the field of genomics. I'll just tell you very, very quickly. Think of an ancestry test, ancestry.com, 23andMe, MyHeritage, and so forth. They primarily do something called SNP-based testing. They study less than 1% of your DNA. That's all you need for accurate ancestry information. But think about it logically. If you want accurate and in-depth health-related information, you're going to get a lot more information if you study your whole DNA. Mm-hmm. That's what whole genome sequencing is, as it sounds. We study the whole genome, the whole DNA. We get like between 1,000 and 5,000 times more data than what you get from an ancestry test. Historically, ancestry companies didn't do whole genome sequencing because it was so expensive, but now the price has come way down. We converted our COVID testing lab into a whole genome sequencing lab. We now have literally world-class equipment, all the newest, latest equipment, four different platforms from the four leading companies in the world. We can provide whole genome sequencing at the same or lower price than virtually anybody in the country, if not in the world. This same business in its infancy. It's where the internet was 20 years ago. That's where we are with whole genome sequencing. What you study in your DNA tells you about diseases you're predisposed to, at risk of, and God forbid you get a cancer, you get a disease, how do you treat it? Two people can get the same cancer, take the same drug, it works on one person, it doesn't work on the other, the difference in your genetic makeup. So all the research is going in this direction. All that research, at the heart of it, is a whole genome sequencing test that we provide at a lower price than anybody in the world. That's only a part of it. We got a big database associated with it. Our genetic database is the equivalent. It's been built over 6 years. The amount of data in it, it's the equivalent of 150 million ancestry tests. We have AI companies dying to do a deal with us for this hidden asset in our company. There's so many different things we can do with Nebula. I am investing in that now, and we're building it. So the same way I invested in and turned around and built the Cold-EEZE brand, sold for a lot of money, doing the exact same thing with Nebula Genomics now. And then our last business, we have a cancer test for esophageal cancer. It's one of the deadliest cancers. People diagnosed with esophageal cancer die 80 to 90% of the time of esophageal cancer within 5 years of being diagnosed. It's a terrible disease. The issue with it is that people are getting diagnosed too late because it's such an inexact science for the diagnosis. People get a routine endoscopy where they stick a tube down your throat. They take tissue specimens. Two pathologists will look at the same tissue specimen under the same microscope. One will tell you if esophageal cancer, one will tell you don't.
Right.
We have a test that'll tell you with almost 100% accuracy whether or not you have esophageal cancer.
Oh, wow.
What the insurance company said is, that's great if you tell us that the person has cancer and it'll be much more accurate. The problem is if the person's going to die anyway, there isn't much we can do. We're still going to suffer the cost as an insurance company. Mm-hmm. However, if you can tell us if the person's at high risk or low risk, now that's something that would be incredibly valuable that would save the insurance companies billions of dollars. Because if you're at high risk, you get a procedure called an ablation that can destroy the precancerous cells before you get esophageal cancer. If you're at low risk, you don't have to get an endoscopy every year. So there's like 70 million endoscopies per year that are performed. 7 million of them are specifically focused on people with pre-esophageal cancer conditions, something called GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease, which is that acid in your stomach. And then that develops into something called Barrett's esophagus. So there's 7 million endoscopies per year. We're not telling people get the endoscopies, but if you get an endoscopy, they're taking 7 to 9 tissue specimens out of your esophagus and studying them. All we need is a sliver of one specimen, run it through our machine, our proprietary test. We have tons of IP on this, by the way. Mm-hmm. And we can tell you not only if you have esophageal cancer or you don't, but we can tell you if you're at high risk or low risk. So if you're at low risk, you don't have to get an endoscopy every year. Saves the insurance company billions of dollars. If you're at high risk, you immediately get the ablation procedure, saving your life. And still saving the insurance company billions of dollars.
Gotta
so
love.
We estimate, this is the last thing I'll say, we estimate that there's 7 million endoscopies. That's our initial target market. We estimate that insurance companies will, based on the CPT codes that we're applying for right now, the CPT codes, we estimate that we'll get reimbursed between $1,000 and $2,000 per endoscopy. And 7 million endoscopies, that's a $7 to $14 billion market. We don't believe that we have any competition at all. There's no test like this in the world. And we're looking to commercialize it later this year. And I happen to think that our Pharmaloz manufacturing facility right now, and certainly later this year, is going to be worth more than the whole market cap of our company.
Wow.
So we've got these two exciting businesses, our Nebula Genomics business and our esophageal cancer test, which are both ramping up later this year. And meanwhile, your downside risk is protected by the value of our Pharmaloz manufacturing facility. That was a mouthful. I hope I didn't talk too much.
No, I absolutely love it. I've got a bunch of questions. Actually, my sister just did a genomics test the other day.
Really?
Yeah, she heard it on Joe Rogan's podcast. She went, she did it, or her husband did, and then they came back with it, and so they learned some interesting stuff. So I'm a big fan of that whole world, and everything you're doing just sounds marvelous. I could spend 2 hours asking you about your company, but I do want to move on. So let me ask you some questions, Ted, about, I mean, you have a really, really interesting and great story and great background. Let's talk about risk. How do you handle risk, and what are some mistakes you see with respect to risk management?
Okay, so in general, what I've observed, and you got to understand, I'm 64 years old, but in my head, I'm 39 years old. I'm in the best shape of my life. I walk 14,000 steps a day. That's my approach to life. That's my approach to managing our company. The biggest mistakes that I see most managements of most companies make is that they take the capital for granted. They don't, they say that they care about dilution, but they don't really. They burn through all the money and then they say, oh, we have these exciting products, but we need more money. And then they do dilutive rounds of financing and they take them for granted too, which is exactly what happened with my first experience with ID Biomedical. That was the Canadian biotech company that I turned around. The CEO did an IPO, raised $30 million. He was running through all that money and the company was going to go bankrupt. I'm like, what are you doing?
Right.
So what I see is most managements, while they say they care about the share price and they care about the shareholders, they really care about their compensation and their salaries more.
Yeah.
And they always say to themselves, I'll just raise more money. If I have to do it at a lower price, too bad. And then they'll give themselves more stock options to make up for it. So they're fine. And meanwhile, the shareholders get burned. So, mm-hmm. So from the point of view of managing a company, I think the most important thing is, see, my background's on Wall Street.
Yeah.
So I think like an investor, which most managements don't. And so the biggest risk I see for investors, when you invest in a brilliant doctor or brilliant scientist, they're great at the invention. They're great with the science. They don't have a clue about business, but they think because they're smart, they know how to manage a business. They don't understand it's a completely different skill set.
I get that 100%. I hear that all day long in my world. So I couldn't agree with you more. That
right.
is spot on. So let's talk about some timeless lessons, Ted. Some timeless lessons you've learned along the way that you want to share with the audience.
Sure.
Life, business, investing, anywhere you want to go.
Sure. Yeah. So look, I have a psychological background. My father was a psychiatrist. I told you about my experience going into psychoanalysis. And so a couple things. First of all, I've learned to talk straight with people. And what's interesting is when I see people that don't talk straight and they BS you, those people also then can't read you. They always say the easiest people to con are con artists, because people that BS you, you can BS back.
Right.
So the most important thing I learned in life is to talk straight with people, because if you talk straight, you pick up on them very quickly when they're not talking straight with you. It's probably the most important thing I ever learned. So I talk straight with people. My son works with me in the business. He's now learned the same thing. And it's amazing how much you can see through the other people when they're BSing you if you're talking straight with them. That's number one. Number two, I learned very early on when I first took over control of our company, and I didn't know how to be a CEO, is I hired a management consultant who taught me so much. And they, two management consultants, taught me to use what's called a trimetrics assessment. It's kind of like a personality assessment, but it really is, and it's so much more. It asks you questions for 30 or 40 minutes, your likes and dislikes, what you would do in a situation in a party. Are you the life of the party? All these different questions, not an IQ test. There's no math questions, no logic questions. It's just asking. It's incredible how accurate it is. And it teaches you that everybody has strengths and weaknesses.
Right.
So for example, I'm great at math. So you think I'd be a great CFO. The truth is I'd be a lousy CFO because I don't like to follow the rules that a CFO has to follow. So what's interesting is a part of the trimetrics assessment is the DISC, D-I-S-C. The D and the I are more about personality. The S and the C is more about steadiness and compliance and following the rules. I'm high D&I. I'm all personality. I'm all sales, lower on the SC scale, where somebody that would make a good CFO would be high on the S&C. So if I'm driving a car and I can drive around somebody, even though I'm not supposed to, if I could drive in the right shoulder to save me 10 minutes, I might do that. Don't get mad at me. A good CFO that has high S&C would never break those kinds of rules, ever. All right. So not that I couldn't be a CFO, but I wouldn't enjoy it. I'm not naturally inclined. This might be a bad example. It makes me sound bad. But the point is, I should be in sales. I shouldn't be a CFO.
No, I get right? it. Yeah.
Perfect example. So anybody interviewing with me for sales position, they better have high D&I. Right. If they have high S&C, I'm like, I'm sorry, you're not wired to be a salesman. You might want that job. You might have experience doing it, but you're not wired. It's not what you naturally want to do. Yeah. So you want to hire somebody whose skill set and wiring fits the responsibilities of the job. Critically important. So the first thing you want to do if you want to hire somebody is internally figure out exactly what are the most important job responsibilities, what's actually important. And then when you interview people, make sure that two things, their skill set, but also how they're naturally inclined to behave fits with the requirements of the job. That's so great. That's a big one. Another one, pressure. Invariably, if you're an entrepreneur, pressure plays a big role. When I'm under pressure, and I was under pressure last year as I and my management team were transitioning the company, I had to remind myself pressure is a privilege. Yeah. I'm the CEO of a public company. It's the greatest privilege in the world. But when I'm under pressure, like I was transitioning the company, I understand we did $200 million in revenues in 2 years. We're making a boatload of money. All of a sudden, all that drops off a cliff. I'm under enormous pressure. I had to remind myself, it's not always easy, but look at the privilege I have to be in a position to do this. So don't take that privilege for granted. If you feel pressure, that's not a bad thing. It means that you're privileged. All right. Another one, raise money opportunistically. It's unbelievable. When a company's stock goes up and management says, I don't need money. You want to save some money for a rainy day.
Right.
As a public company, you want to actually raise the money when you don't need it. When you need the money, it's impossible to raise. When you don't need it, it's easy to raise. Raise it when your stock price is high, when you can raise money easily, when it's not going to hurt your stock price, so that you have the capital. Most small businesses fail because they're undercapitalized.
Yeah.
Critically, critically important. And probably one of the best rules of all, I learned this from my former COO, CFO, who I worked with in turning around the Cold-EEZ brand. He said, when you're walking down the hallway with two buckets of water and a little water splashes out along the way, by the time you get to the end of the hallway, those buckets are almost empty. So think about your company. If you manage it, it's a little bit here. You overpay this person here. You have two people over here who shouldn't be working the company. You feel bad. You let them stay anyway. All those expenses add up and they can take you down. It's critically important to pay attention to wasteful spending. And of course, the last thing, I'm passionate. I think you have to be passionate about your business, or what are you doing in business? Why would it? You shouldn't be investing in a management team that's not passionate about what they're doing.
Yeah, and I take that and say life also. What are you doing? Just you be passionate about life and everything you're doing in it. I love that. Beautiful. So how about some timeless mistakes that you've made or you've seen other people make, and how do you avoid them?
Well, I already covered a couple of the timeless mistakes. I still make mistakes all the time. Look, we made a ton of money in COVID testing. To some extent, I probably took it for granted. It's easy to do. You know, because when I first turned around the company, I watched every single penny. I mean, I had one person when I took over control of the company. There were 26 people in the headquarters. Within 6 months, I had fired 22 of them. There was one guy making $45,000 a year in the marketing department. I fired him. It's only $45,000. Put that in perspective.
Yeah.
But it was the right thing to do because it was wasteful spending. If it was only $45,000. You know, I sold the brand for $50 million, but still about $45,000. It's easy to get sloppy when you're making a lot of money.
Right.
So now when the COVID testing stopped and the revenues dropped and the earnings dropped, mm-hmm. I had to go back and refocus my attention. Could I have done it a little sooner? Honestly, probably. But that's what I'm doing now. The other thing is mistakes. You know, you can't be successful if you don't make mistakes. It's impossible. Here we are, we transition from COVID testing to these other businesses. Every business I buy, every asset we acquire isn't going to be successful. Do you want to call it a mistake? Yes, each individual initiative that fails, you can call that a mistake. But if I do 10 initiatives and three of them make our company worth $1 billion, were the other seven a mistake? Because if I didn't do the other seven, I wouldn't have done the three successful ones.
100%.
So mistakes are a part of the business. You have to expect you're going to make mistakes. The question is, are you right more than you're wrong? And you cut your mistakes, you cut your losses short, and you focus on what's successful. So we had other assets, other initiatives over the last several years that we basically have discarded. We're focusing on three initiatives right now in various stages of development, but the risk reward on all three are fantastic. And I'm not focused on all the other stuff now. So yes, did I make mistakes? Absolutely. Do I get upset about the mistakes? For a moment in time, I do. But at the end of the day, the other thing I teach everybody is don't be penny wise and pound foolish. Right. Think about the big picture. So if I write off some assets that didn't work out, so what? As long as I'm focusing on the big picture and developing the assets that have big value, write off the other stuff. If something's a sunk cost, write it off, move on.
I love it. I love it. It's almost, somebody gave me a really good analogy one time. It's like having a garden and your losses are the weeds. Every garden gets attacked. You're going to have weeds. It's part of the process.
Yes. Yes.
It was Peter Lynch who actually wrote in this book, One Up on Wall Street, way back in the 80s. He goes, it's kind of like cutting the flowers and letting your weeds grow.
Right.
Don't trim the losses. So the losses are the weeds, the wins are the flowers. So he said, always let the flowers grow, you know, let the winners run, but get rid of those weeds. And
yes.
What most people do is they do the opposite. So yeah, I love what you said there.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was really good stuff. All right, beautiful. Thank you for that. Now, you taught yourself how to become a CEO, Ted. You're a natural leader. You've got the charisma. You've got that je ne sais quoi, for lack of a better word. What makes a great leader in your experience? And what are some lessons about leadership that you'd like to share with us?
So first of all, everybody has strengths and weaknesses. You can't get upset with somebody because of their weaknesses. You have to learn to empower those around you to give them responsibilities that match with their strengths and understand their weaknesses instead of criticizing them and being critical of them, of their weaknesses, because everybody has weaknesses.
Yeah.
So if you're going to focus on the weaknesses, you're going to demotivate everybody around you. Nobody's going to want to work with you. So I think it's critically important to understand people. Again, I actually think as CEO, one of the most important attributes is understanding psychology. You think business is all about, you know, dollars and revenues and earnings, but the truth of the matter is it's all about psychology. It's all about working with people, because if you can't work with people, I can't do this by myself. I can't do any of this by myself.
Right.
All right. We have a lab business. I don't have a science background. I don't know the first thing about the laboratory.
Right.
I have to understand how to recognize talent in other people, hire the right people, let them do their job, finance them, give them the capital that's needed, the support they need, hire the right people, and also understand, you know, I'm thinking back to some of the mistakes. You know, I hired some people here who are great at one job, but then when we transitioned to, into other businesses, I didn't realize they were not good at right. managing the other businesses. And that actually, that set me back. So I had to learn to say, hey, you did a great job, but you're not a fit with our company with what we're doing now. Mm-hmm. So it really created growing pains. And you don't think after your big successful company, you'd have growing pains, but you always have growing pains because you always want to go to the next level. Right. You're always going to have pullbacks. You're always transitioning your businesses. And so I've gone through a lot of growing pains. But I think we have a stronger management team now than we've ever had before. Not sure if that answered your question. I went on some tangents, but this is real life, what I've been going through with our company.
Yeah, it definitely does. And actually, it brings up to your earlier point, too, about knowing your strengths and weaknesses in the CFO role, which you're not good at because you're not that quote-unquote rule follower, and the roles where you are good at, the psychology, knowing thyself, and so on and so forth. So if the guy's really good at role A, but you need skill B to do that job, and he doesn't have that skill, even though he was good at A, now you're transitioned, you got to make sure someone's good at
100%. And I'll give you a really simple example. I'm not going to call anybody out on this, but I had some people that were great at building our COVID lab. They're in the laboratory business for decades. They really knew the COVID space because that's a part of what's known as a high complexity molecular lab. So I thought, okay, let's build out a genomics lab, right? So I figured I got these great people that did such a great job with our high complexity molecular lab. Let's build out a genomics lab. Turned out not so good. So I had to refocus, and I had to bring in people whose expertise was specifically in genomics to do the genomics lab. That was a mistake I made. But so anyway, that's a part of life, and that's a part of learning. And it's about being flexible, and you're not always going to be right. And I made mistakes. I just described some mistakes I made. Yeah. But the question is, you have to bounce back from them. And that also goes back to the point that you need capital. It's interesting. I talk to institutional investors sometimes, say, I don't like to invest in companies unless they have a lot of excess capital that they don't need, which is an interesting point. I never really thought of it that way, but it's smart because then you can handle the mistakes and continue to grow and deal with the growing pains.
I love it. All right, two more questions for you, and then we can wrap up for today. Ted, thank you so much as always. This is really, really fantastic, and I'm enjoying the conversation. Let's talk about adversity and obstacles. How do you handle adversity, and what are some obstacles you had to overcome?
Right. So, listen, at the end of the, you know, I'm just thinking about the word adversity and what adversity means. But what's coming to me right now, adversity could be things like issues, regulatory issues, could be class action lawsuits. It could be different things that I've come across over my career as CEO of our company. It can really scare you. I used to have these class action lawsuits when we had the Cold-EEZE brand. And the funny thing is, our claims were incredibly accurate. We had clinical studies backing the claims, but we had class action lawsuits anyway. I was like, oh no. And you have to work through that stuff. And you have to, so adversity is something you have to learn to work through. It's, you have to expect that there are going to be surprises. There's going to be adversity. If business was easy, everybody would do it. Everybody would be a billionaire. It just doesn't work like that. So if you think you're not going to have growing pains and you're not going to have adversity, don't be an entrepreneur and don't try and build a business. Go work for somebody else.
Yep.
You're going to have adversity. The question is, how do you respond to it? Do you work through it and fight through it, or don't you? Are you a fighter? Mm-hmm. I have this phenomenal relationship with our investment bankers, Think Equity. Love Think Equity. Don't mind shouting them out. They financed us 3 years ago, gave us $37.5 million. I used that to build a multi-hundred million dollar business. They love me. I was one of the few CEOs that actually executed with the money they raised. On the other hand, I'm loyal to them. because they know I get it. And we have this great relationship in working together. But what they like best about me is when there's adversity, when there are issues, I fight through it. They pump me up. Joe Jagobin, the CEO of Think Equity, is the same way. He's focused every morning. He walks 5 miles or runs 5 miles every morning. He's the most successful guy in the world. He could probably retire, and yet he doesn't. This is a mindset. And he's under pressure every day. He fights through it. He has adversity every day. I do too. He says, Ted, you got to fight through it. I know you're going to come out on top. And that's what I do. That's how I run my company. That's how I live my life. That's why I think I told you at the beginning, I walk 14,000 steps a day. I just did 3 investor calls before this interview. I put on my headphones. I was walking outside. So what? I probably got in 10,000 steps while doing 3 hours of telephone calls. I haven't even gone to the gym yet, and I've already done my steps for the day.
Right. No, I love it. I love it. Actually, I just spoke to the Think Equity folks just a few days ago about some other matter. I had Joe and Bill on the phone for something else, but they're really, really great guys. So, all right, next question for you, and then we can wrap up. What's the best piece of advice, Ted, that you'd like to give the audience or your 30-year-old self?
There is no one piece of advice. We just covered so much on this call. Listen, I would go back to, first of all, in my head, I think like I'm 39 years old. I don't care that I'm 64 years old. I want to live like I'm 39. And I do when I go to the gym every day. Really the most important piece of advice, if you want to be successful in business or in life, is to be honest. It's just amazing the sort of the cover that's lifted off your head, the weight that's lifted off of you when you're honest. Because when you're honest, then you can read people, you can understand people, you can develop better relationships. Relationships are so critically important in business. Like, you can't take them for granted. If you think the guys at Think Equity can't tell the difference between somebody BSing them and somebody that doesn't, believe me, they can. But they can see I talk straight with them, they talk straight with me. So they know that they can trust me. So they'll go, if I ever needed to raise money or need capital, I know they'll raise it for me in a heartbeat, because they know I'm not going to take advantage of them and I'm not going to BS them. Right. It's critically important to building a company, especially a microcap company, is have a relationship with an investment bank where you understand their business, they understand you. But more importantly, probably the most important life lesson I learned, it's just to talk straight with people and to be honest. Then you can read people, you develop the better relationships, you'll be more successful in business, you'll be more successful in life.
I love it. Well, Ted, thank you so much for taking the time to speak today. I really enjoyed the conversation, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Awesome. Adam, thank you so much. This was a pleasure. I loved your questions. I love the format. I wish you the best of luck. This was super. Thank you. You made my day.
Likewise.